Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I go through my current version of my Sunday sermon. What would your life be like if you lived a sinless life? If I lived a sinless life, could I do miracles? Would everyone love me? Would bad things happen to me? Would I have success in everything I pursued? Would I secure for myself the life I've always wanted? In many ways, this question is played with in the book of Job. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. Notice that's 10 children. All of those are sort of perfect numbers. And of course, they preferred sons, so more sons than daughters. And he owned 7,000 sheep. Notice another 7. 3,000 camels. 500 yoke of oxen and 500 donkeys, 7 and 3, 10, 5 and 5, 10, and a large number of servants, slaves. He was the greatest man among all the peoples of the East. His sons used to hold feasts in their homes on their birthdays, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom. So Job, if your definition of perfection is a religious one, Job was the best. He, in fact, looked after his children. He did everything right. Now, maybe you're more of the justest variety of righteousness. Well, Job had that covered too. Job chapter 29. "When I went to the gate of the city, I took my seat in the public square. The young men saw me and stepped aside, and the old men rose to their feet. The chief men refrained from speaking and covered their mouths with their hands. The voice of the nobles were hushed, and their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouths. Whoever heard me spoke well of me, and those who saw me commended me, because I rescued the poor who cried for help, and the fatherless who had none to assist them. The one who was dying blessed me. I made the widow's heart sing. I put on righteousness as my clothing. Justice was my robe and my turban. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy. I took up the case of the stranger. I broke the fangs of the wicked and snatched the victims from their teeth." Job was the perfect man. He was perfectly religious. He was perfectly just. He is the picture of moral perfection that you can find in the Hebrew Scriptures. How did his life go? Well, very famously, it went very badly. His sons and daughters were killed. His riches were taken away. His wife says, "Curse God and die." And even his friends came and basically said, "Job, karma says you had this coming." Now, sort of like that old Dan Aykroyd, Eddie Murphy movie where these two old geezers decide to wage a bet and mess with their lives, maybe the system would have worked if God hadn't messed with the system and Satan hadn't come in. Maybe the way the world works is like karma. Do good things and you get good things. Do bad things and you get bad things. Is this the way the world works? Some would say no. It's just power and chaos. If chaos doesn't interfere, then just marshal the power you need to go out and secure the life you've always wanted. But if chance breaks in and destroys your life beyond your power, there's nothing you can do. These are really the options, when you boil it down to it, that most people look to. If God runs the world, he won't let anything really bad happen to a good person. Islam regards Jesus as a great prophet. Many argue that he didn't die on the cross because God wouldn't let such a great prophet die in such a humiliating way. Many people, Christian, Muslim, spiritual but not religious, implicitly agree with this idea. Do the right thing, be moral, be spiritual, light a candle, say a prayer, be good to the poor, be for justice. It's all insurance. Some conclude from the bad things that do happen that this just isn't true. And so they leave religion, and maybe they still dabble in spiritual a little bit just in case, but they leave religion and become skeptics or atheists or something like that. But even they often sort of shrink back from moral nihilism. They would say things like, well, society works better if people at least believe the myths like this because it encourages them to be kind or nice or generous, even if everything is just going to die in the universe and it'll be gone forever. Now, we've been following Jesus in the middle of his culture war, and he's heading to Jerusalem. And there's great anticipation as to what will happen when Jesus gets to Jerusalem. A man who can still a storm can make a storm. A man who can raise the dead can cause, it's far easier to make men dead than to raise the dead. We've known that forever. So what is going to happen when Jesus gets to Jerusalem? Are they just going to grab him and crucify him? Or will Jesus call down angels, etc., etc., etc.? Luke 9, as the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. Now, I don't think taken up to heaven means died there. It's talking about the ascension. And as crowds increased, Jesus isn't terribly nice to the crowds. This wicked generation, it asks for a sign, but none will be given except the sign of Jonah. Luke 12, the crowds increase further. When a crowd of many thousands had gathered, so that they were trampling on one another, Jesus began to speak to his disciples, "Be on guard against the yeast of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy." Luke 14, large crowds were traveling with Jesus. Luke is making the point. Chapter after chapter after chapter, he's noting the movement, the growth in momentum and anticipation of what will happen when Jesus gets to Jerusalem. And turning to them, he says, "If anyone comes after me and does not hate father and mother, wife and child, brother and sister, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple." Is Jesus saying we have to die for him? Will there be a battle? Will it be dangerous? Will it cost me my life? "Whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be their disciple." Carry their cross? Now, we want to put our enemies on crosses. That's the way this works, Jesus. It doesn't seem real clear on that. But some might look at this and say, well, you know, Jesus says to love your enemies, but look at what he said about the Pharisees. Jesus is hard on the teachers of the law. Jesus is hard on the Pharisees. But yet, repeatedly, we find Jesus eating with Pharisees and teachers of the law. And you might say, well, he has to stop for a meal. No. That's not how that culture worked. Again, back to Ken Bailey. To eat with another person in the Middle East is a sacramental act signifying acceptance on a very deep level. So Jesus would eat with Pharisees and teachers of the law. We see him again and again and again in the Gospel of Luke eating with these people. Now, he's disputing with them, but he's eating with them, and that sort of keeps the relationship there. Many times over the decades, I have stayed to partake of a meal in a village because of this reality. I neither wanted nor needed the food offered and could ill afford the time. By eating with a person, however, I was accepting that person on a basic and very fundamental level. If the guest is a religious teacher or a leader, the villagers believe the guest imparts a semi-physical blessing by mere presence. Jesus is eating with his enemies, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, those that we today often, especially in Protestant churches, say, oh, they're the legalists. Jesus is eating with legalists. And Luke 15. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus, but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." In chapter 14 and chapter 13 and chapter 12, he was eating with Pharisees and teachers of the law too. Jesus will eat with anyone, it seems. Now, I'd like to know, who aren't you allowed to eat with? Because think about it. Now, eating doesn't have the same cultural connotation for us today. But you have rivals and enemies, don't you? Palestine in the first century was occupied by imperialists. It is difficult for anyone who has never lived in an occupied country to fully appreciate the hatred generated towards the collaborator. Modern African and Asian nationals give us many parallels. He's writing this in the 70s. In modern Arab politics, the bitterest of all insults is agent of the imperialists. When a colony approaches the ignition point of revolt, it hates any collaborator with ferocious intensity. Suddenly, the collaborator's compromises with national honor become undurable. In Jesus' day, nationalistic forces in Judea and Galilee were gathering strength. The smolderings of revolt would burst into flames within a few years. Any cooperation with Rome and its tax collectors was surely looked on as a betrayal of race and religion. Even today, there are few things that grip us as strongly as race and religion, even if your religion is implicit. He eats with sinners and tax collectors, and he also eats with you. But notice what Jesus says. Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Doesn't he leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. Then he calls his friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep." I tell you that in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. Wait a minute. Jesus, who are you calling a sinner? By eating with everyone, aren't you saying that there aren't any sinners, that we're just misunderstood? It's not what he's saying. Or suppose a woman has 10 coins and loses one. Doesn't she light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost coin." In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Well, who's the sinner? Is it the tax collector? That's certainly what the Pharisees and the teachers of the law think. Probably in this case, the tax collectors probably agree. It's a dirty profession, and they're doing it. Now, the hearing of this text, I believe, has been inverted by the counterculture, because in our culture, promoted by usually the highest status, most elite people in the culture, tells us, at least since the counterculture, to ask questions, take chances, be a rebel, chart your own way, don't listen to any dogma, do your own thing. Such people are considered rebels or sinners by the polite society, by the powers that be, by the man. Didn't Jesus push back against religious conformity? Wasn't Jesus a revolutionary? Well, conformity is the problem. And then everybody listens to Steve Jobs and says, "Don't accept dogma." Well, didn't he just give you a dogma? What I'm saying is that so often when we hear the story of the prodigal son, we're sort of cheering for the rebels. We're sort of cheering for the one that goes their own way. We're sort of cheering for the sinners. And oh, look, Jesus meets with sinners, but the sinners are always sort of sanitized, and they're the good kind of sinners. So before we read this, you really have to ask, who is your enemy? Who is the wrongdoer in your home or office or nation or world? Who is the out-group? Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off to a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. Now, I'm changing the NIV because I think the NIV has it wrong. Because quite literally, the text says, he came to himself. Well, what does that mean? So the NIV will say something like, he came to his senses, but he came to his senses in a very pragmatic way. Reconciliation with the Father is not part of the plan. The plan is really to save his own skin. This is a face-saving effort. Kenneth Bailey in the text says, when people in that culture get at odds, they can't lose face. And so there needs to be an intermediary who will come between them and broker a reconciliation between them and make amends. Who would have been the person to do that when the younger son is asking the father to cash out his inheritance? Well, that would have been the older brother. Why didn't he do that? So now in the far-off country, he came to himself, and he said, how many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me one of your hired servants. See, now the problem is we think that and we say, oh no, the father's going to welcome him in because we've already heard the story. But no one in that culture would have believed that because that's not how it worked. So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him, and he ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. That sinned against heaven and against you? That sinned against heaven? That's Pharaoh's speech. Pharaoh will give that speech and then turn around on it. The son is not a hero here. But the father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fatted calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. And if we stopped it here, it would match all the other parables that we have just had of the lost sheep and the lost coin. It's exactly the same structure, except now we have a son who has gotten lost. And you don't earn sonship by working, just like you don't earn an inheritance. Now, we like to identify with the son here, and Jesus' listeners would not have. Certainly not the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. The prodigal son is not a repentant sinner. Not yet, at least. The story is about the elder, responsible, righteous son. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. He called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. Your brother has come, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. Now, the older brother knows his younger brother is a sinner. His younger brother has, well, what does he deserve? He's done bad things. He deserves bad things. The brother deserves the karmic reaction the universe is going to give him, or should give him, and the father has interrupted it. His brother deserves God's judgment, and would have had the judgment of the village if the father had not run out and protected the son from the judgment of the village that would have cut him off. The father upends God and karma. The father upends justice. The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, you don't talk to your father like that." "He does, because he's thinking about disinheriting him." You don't disinherit a father. You inherit from the father. "Look, all these years I have been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. You never gave me even a young goat that I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home and kills the fattened calf for you, you kill the fattened calf for him." "My son," the father said, "you are always with me, and everything I have is yours." Notice how the father, just like he did with the younger brother, now overlooks the insult that the older brother gives him. The father's done it again. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He's resurrected. He was lost and is found. What would your life be like if you lived a sinless life? Did the older brother live a sinless life? Was he getting the reward he was due for all of his obedience? He says to his father, "I've been completely obedient to you, and look what you've given me." In some ways, there's an echo of Job here. In this world, being perfect may very well give you a life that looks like Jesus. If you are not even somewhat disturbed or offended by Jesus, the Jesus you find in the Gospels, you're probably seeing through a tribal defensive projection. Let's try this language. You're probably looking at him through religious embroidery of 2,000 years. Now, in my adult Sunday school class, I asked an Australian, if the Chinese invaded your country and took your wives and daughters as their sex slaves, something that happened during the Second World War, the Japanese did it to the Koreans, and the Koreans are still upset by it, how would you feel about the Chinese? Wouldn't you hate them? Wouldn't you want them dead? Wouldn't you say they have done a horrible injustice? That's what the Romans were doing to the Jews. They had every right to be angry. Jesus does these things, and they don't kill him because somehow the people of the land were so much more horrible than we are. These are really very natural expected reactions. What Jesus is saying here, what the older brother bears witness to here, what the Pharisees and the teachers of the law are noticing here is very real. The church often plays sort of Jesus defense attorney for our little rival spats with others. Now, this is dimmed partially because over the last 2,000 years, Jesus has really changed our moral calibrations of what is good, bad, right, and wrong. And so we don't read Jesus through the eyes of those who are around him, because Jesus has redefined for us what is good. But again, I ask you, if you were to live a sinless life, what would your expectations be? We all want a good life. Job's life looked pretty good. We want to reliably secure it if we can. And maybe we hope religion will do that for us. Job and Jesus tell us that this is not the way the world works. Now we can see, however, in this story, the audacious love of the Father. And it is an offensive love. The love seems unjust. That's what the older brother sees. Because the rebellious son isn't cute or cool or a trailblazer or of little concern. He tanks the economy of the village. His actions have clear consequences in everyone's life. Everyone hurt by the younger brother has a real injury to point to. He has ravaged the father, the brother, and the village, and is beyond repair. And the consequences are beyond repair in some ways. Yet the father rejoices at his return and leverages his love for the son's restoration, because that's the plan for redeeming the son. He's going to show him love. And maybe, just maybe, the son will grow in gratitude. And the question is, will the older brother join in that project? That's the question that Jesus has to the Pharisees and the teachers of the law that he's been eating with too. We like the story if we cast ourselves in the role of the prodigal son. And each of us has a claim on that. Our rebellions are costly too. But each of us must also accept the label of sinner. We must also consider our participation in the part of the elder brother. There are people out there that are alienated from us, sometimes justly. What part will we play? We must see that it is love that God uses to restore us, which is exactly what Jesus is about to do, what he's going down to Jerusalem to do. It's Communion Sunday. We have wronged the Father. We have not sought reconciliation between the Father and other sinners. We have wronged the Father as both elder and younger sons. Both rebel against the Father in their own way. Jesus wins us back with his costly love. Will we do so for each other?